Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth. The following episode of the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Before we go in, I just want you to know that until now, no other person besides myself has been in this room. I just want to ask that no food or drink be brought inside. Is this just a test, or do I have seconds to live?
You know, Ern, radiation death is an ugly thing.
This machine shows it an afterlife. It proves it. You just threw away a chance to be very rich. Very important.
Now, my friends, the only difference between a soul that is saved and a soul that is lost is that one is saved. The other's lost. You know this whore of Moscow?
Mr. Blick, you've been quoted as saying that this invention will change the way people will think about their lives. What exactly did you mean by that?
People will be happy and not sad. I have a gun.
Yes, so have I.
If I hijack this bus, then the press would come real quick. I mean, I wouldn't really hijack it. Oh, no, this is stupid.
No, hijacking. Hijacking.
This is the culmination of over 2 years of nearly continuous work.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is writer Chris Cummins.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we're looking at the 1985 film Static, directed by Mark Romanek and co-written by Romanek and Keith Gordon. Static also stars Gordon as Ernie Blick, an inventor in a small town with big ideas. He works for a while at a company that makes plastic crucifixes, taking the rejects home with him for his collection. That kind of ties into his real passion project, creating a closed-circuit surveillance system of heaven. Chris, tell me about your experience with this film, when you first saw it, and why it stuck with you over all these years.
I first got cable in late 1988, and at the time, it was just the package that my family had got was basic cable, and the one premium channel was this Philadelphia-based channel called Prism. And Prism was essentially the Philly equivalent of the Z Channel. They would have a lot of B-movies, cult movies, softcore, and some local programming towards the end before Prism went off. What they would show is a lot of really interesting films that I'd never heard of before and a lot of crap. Fortunately, I was able to see a lot of great things there for the first time. Miracle Mile I saw for the first time. For some reason, they'd show the movie Rat Boy all the time, which was very interesting to me that that was always being shown on there. But one time, while waiting for a movie to come on, I saw this trailer, and it was a trailer for Static. And it was a very strange trailer, and just the whole notion of the film appealed to me about this man who creates this, you know, this device, which is what Gordon creates in the film, which we'll get into in a bit. And it was an interesting enough trailer to lure me into the film. And after I got done watching They Live, which was the movie I was waiting for, which I also saw for the first time on Prism, I wanted to seek out the next screening of Static, which I did, and the rest is history.
I remember seeing this one on the shelf at Liberty Street Video in Ann Arbor, and it was, I mean, gosh, this was like early 90s, and for some reason this film, just the box cover, I guess, intrigued me. And then when I saw that Keith Gordon was in it, I was a huge, going to another John Carpenter film, I was a huge fan of Christine, And I said, okay, well, I want to see what else this guy has done. And when I saw that he had co-written it and produced it, I was like, all right, yeah, let's check this out. And yeah, it was just so quirky. And I think that's probably a word that gets bandied about a lot when looking at this film. You know, the characters remind me a little bit. I mean, it's like David Lynch light kind of at times.
Yeah.
The direction reminds me a little bit of Lynch as far as the saturation of colors. It's a little blue velvety, but it's like a non-evil blue velvet. You know, there's no Frank Booth in this film. It's more like, you know, if Jeffrey lived in a nicer town and there was no Lincoln Avenue, then maybe it would be the city that Static takes place in.
Right. Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that about Lynch, because when I was rewatching it for the podcast, one of the notes I actually wrote was low rent Lynch. And I kind of feel bad about that because I don't feel it's necessarily trying to ape David Lynch. I feel like the Lynch influence is obvious, but I also feel that Romanek was trying to, you know, create his own style that, while clearly influenced by Lynch, was trying to go its own way as well. Definitely you see that when you're introduced to the plumber character, both on stage and when she's driving her car, which leads into the events of the film. There are some real visually striking moments in the film.
Now, we should say that that's Amanda Plummer, and there's not actually a plumber in the film. Yeah, it's got a great cast to it. I mean, Gordon, I always love Keith Gordon and whatever he's in. And Amanda Plummer is kind of like this, rock and roller that you see at the beginning. And
yeah. And she has kind of a meltdown on stage. And it's a really great song, too, I have to add. I don't know who actually did the song for real, but it's very good. I was looking in the Destroy All Movies book trying to find some information, and there's nothing in there about Static, sadly. But she's a really interesting character, and as we'll get into, the movie is kind of her movie, ultimately. At least that's the way I take it.
The structure of the film is very fascinating to me, just that it really has two very distinct halves. I mean, they're not broken in too cleanly as far as, you know, okay, at the, you know, if this is an 81-minute film, it's not at the, you know, I'm not good at math, but whatever half of 81, the 40-minute and 30-second mark, is it broken? But it's more like after the end of the second act, the third act just goes completely in a different way. It ties into the first act, but yeah, it's after Ernie shows his invention to folks, and he's really the only one that it works for, he goes into this other little adventure that takes the film really in a different way, but for me, it all works.
It's a absolute tonal shift, but it definitely works for me as well. The movie gets very comical for a period when Ernie first first encounters the women on the bus, and then, wow, the rug gets pulled out from the audience.
Completely. They really were very free in their thinking as far as what they could do with the plot.
You know, it's kind of cliche to say, but it does kind of almost collapse under the weight of its own ambition at times. You have a lot of big ideas. I mean, when we first meet Ernie, he's working in this very Orwellian crucifix factory, which is a very strange thing. I mean, you never, you know, obviously crucifixes are produced, and you never think about, okay, these are people's jobs to basically quality control crucifixes. Or crucifies, as you said. There's a lot of interesting ideas in the movie. Some get more developed than others. But the fact that they're all in the movie does feel like this is a young director who is bursting with creativity, who has a lot of things he wants to say. And in Static, he was successful saying some of the things more than other things.
Right, and I think it was very smart to start off the film with the crucifix scene. I mean, not only does it set up some of the themes later on as far as the heaven thing and Ernie's parents and all these kind of things, but it's just so visually striking. It's very clever, and it's very, you know, like, what is going on here? And then when he goes home and he puts up that newest addition to his collection, and you pull back and you see that whole display of these wrong crucifixes, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is really kind of cool. And I think that Romanek has a real awesome visual style. I love the way that he uses colors in the film, especially during the revelation of Ernie's invention, that blue room that they go into. And there's a lot of blues, a lot of oranges, you know, which also helps as far as the Western setting, the kind of desert town setting of this film. And, you know, the scene where they're out there watching the sunset, which could just be completely cliche, but I think they take it away from that and they make it not only visually interesting, but also you're really paying more attention to what the characters are saying as well.
There were two visuals that really stuck out with me. One was just the look of the fish cafe. The establishing shot of that was a really, really interesting shot to me. And also the whole sequence where Frank is preaching outside of the motel where Ernie is living. It's a very orange, very kind of... It's a strange kind of orange, too. It's kind of like a burnt, sad orange, if orange can have an emotion. That was the way I took it, but it's a really interesting, visually looking film. There are times, especially during the opening sequence with This Is the Day, where he's foreshadowing his own career as a music video director in some of these sequences.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit more about Romanek, because this was his first film. You know, he and Gordon had met on Home Movies. They both worked on that, the Brian De Palma project. And the soundtrack for this film is great. You know, you mentioned the, I would consider that a punk song. And then, yeah, when we see Amanda Plummer driving along and you've got the song going on, and it's just like, wow, this really fits. And the music really just works really well with the visuals in this film.
The song, which is actually also used incredibly effectively in an awful movie that is a guilty pleasure of mine called Empire Records, which is a horrible, horrible film. But
it is a horrible film, yes.
But not to derail the conversation here. But it's whenever that song is kind of tailor-made to be used in a secondary product outside of its existence as a song, and in the film it's used perfectly. And it really is great at being evocative and setting mood.
After Romanek did this, it was a long time before he did another feature film. I think his next one was One Hour Photo, the one with Robin Williams, and that wasn't a whole lot of long ago. But in between then, he had an amazing career as a video director.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I went on to Wikipedia, and I know if you can't believe Wikipedia, you can't believe anything. Right after this, he ended up doing a video for The. He did the Sweet Bird of Truth. And then I just pretty much picked up on the ones that where the videos really stood out for me, where the songs stood out for me as well. So I was looking up, he had done Madonna of the Wasps by Robin Hitchcock.
It's a great video. MTV 120 Minutes used to play it a lot. It was tremendous.
And then Devil's Haircut with Beck in it, as being played by Michael Cera. Just kidding. Those two are like separated at birth or something in that one. And then that creepy pedophile video, Criminal by Fiona Apple.
Right.
I don't know which came first with that one. If it was the, do you remember that whole controversy? What was it, like the Levi's jeans commercials with, or print ads?
Yeah, that were sexualizing like young girls. Yeah, I think that was around about the same time, and both kind of, you know, very, very creepy.
And then creepy but super effective to me, The Perfect Drug by Nine Inch Nails, which I just love that video. I'm not a big Nine Inch Nails fan, but I really like that one.
He's kind of masterful at establishing mood, as I said earlier, and he did it in that video. I mean, look, the guy made the Michael Jackson's Janet Jackson's Scream video, which was was kind of a comeback video for Jackson at the time, because he'd been doing a lot of, you know, his last really high-profile video was that Remember the Time mess with Magic Johnson and Eddie Murphy, and then he kind of did quieter videos, but Scream brought him back in a big way, and it's a very interesting video visually in terms of his use of anime and black and white, and it's pretty great.
And then another one that I really like a lot too, and it was funny, I didn't even realize until I was doing the research, I don't go out and buy DVDs with music videos on them hardly ever at all. I think I maybe bought one or two of those sets when it was like Spike Jones and Chris Cunningham. But I picked up the video for Audio Slave because they had that awesome video for Cochise, which was an homage to Vanishing Point. And which is funny because we're actually going to be talking about Vanishing Point on the projection booth at some point in the next few months. But yeah, it's just it was very interesting to see that he had done that as well, really captured the look and feel. And again, another like desert setting that was pretty much the only similarities that are there between that one and Static. But you know, it was kind of nice to see that. So I was like, oh, I actually own a Mark Romanek video, and I didn't even know it, other than Static, that is. Of course, he really just kind of took home a lot of awards and really got a lot of notice with his video for Hurt by Johnny Cash, speaking of Nine Inch Nails, a cover of a Nine Inch Nails song, which is just, you know, that video will tear your heart out.
Absolutely. I'm a guy like who actually loves, I have tons of DVDs that have, you know, that are just music video DVDs. Whenever an artist that I like puts them out, no matter how bad, you know, I tend to buy those up. So I'm a huge music video guy. And for my money, I mean, I think Hurt is the most effective music video that has ever been made. I don't want to give into hyperbole here, but there is not a more effective use of the medium than that video. It is devastating to watch Johnny Cash there looking, you know, it's intercut, so it's as if he's looking back on his life. He's in the house of Cash, which has been ravaged by, like, the years as well as, like, a flood, and I think they maybe had a fire around the time of the video as well. And June Carter's there, and she's hovering over him like a ghost, and it was shortly before her death. It's a devastating, devastating thing to watch, and the power of the song just lyrically combines with the visuals beautifully, and again, I cannot think of a more effective music video than that. And I know that video got a lot of acclaim, but it still is the best video ever made as far as I'm concerned.
So I don't know if you've ever seen 1 Hour Photo. I believe I have seen it. It's one of these films.
I've seen it. I remember liking it till about the end, and I think it kind of fell apart at the end. I guess it was that's a 2002 movie, so I guess I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it on HBO or something, and not a fan of Robin Williams, the comedian, but I am a fan of Robin Williams, the dramatic actor. So I thought he gave a tremendous portrayal. He was, you know, it was effective, but I feel it's a movie that was trying to say a lot of things and didn't really get to say any of them adequately.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there was studio interference with that one or not. I think there were rumors of it, but I don't know if they were ever confirmed or denied by Romanek or anyone else. But and then after 1 Hour Photo, apparently Romanek was attached to A Million Little Pieces, the James Frey novel.
Yeah.
And before that whole thing imploded. And then he dodged a bullet by not having to direct The Wolfman, the Benicio del Toro travesty of justice.
That's an accurate way to describe that movie, absolutely.
I've not seen Never Let Me Go, which was Romanek's last feature film, which apparently you have.
Yeah, I have, and Never Let Me Go is a very interesting movie. It's based on a book, which I'll just say I haven't read, but apparently fans of the novel were disappointed with the book. The book is basically about these English kids who are, I don't even think this is a spoiler alert, but basically they are raised to have their organs harvested. It's set in a world where disease is pretty much eradicated because these people are assigned to have their organs harvested when healthy people get sick. So
that sounds exactly like parts The Clonus Horror and The Island to me.
I think I'm kind of underselling it. Because it is quite effective, but, you know, the kids kind of, you know they're different, and it's essentially a love story, and Carey Mulligan's in it, Andrew Garfield's in it, and everybody in it is very good, and it's a slight drama, because you see where everything is going. I feel like towards the end, you know, it's a movie 5 minutes in, you know exactly what's going to happen, and then that plays out. So there's no real drama. You get kind of attached to the characters, but you don't really care enough. And everything feels so truncated, and knowing that it was from this massive book that got, you know, edited down to a 90 to 100-minute film, it feels like there was a lot lacking. It's beautiful to look at. It is very well directed. I do recommend seeing it, but it's kind of a slight movie.
Let's go ahead. We're going to take a break, and rather than come back and chat a little bit more, we're going to come back right with an interview with Keith Gordon, and then we will be back after that in order to talk. So we'll see you on the other side.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today. Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
I still have nothing but fond feelings for that project.
It really stands up.
Yeah, I think so too. I really like it. I go back to it. I'm pleased with it. I mean, yes, there are definitely moments where I go, okay, I was 25. You know, there are moments that are, I don't know, you know, adolescent or whatever, or young, or but I still think it's a really good film. I've always been sad that, you know, Mark sort of kind of disowned it.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I contacted him, and he was just like, no thanks, don't want to talk about it. I was like, oh, that's a shame, because I've really liked this movie.
You know, I've never fully understood what it was that he didn't like about it. I mean, I never really quite got why he didn't want to talk about it, have it put out on video, all that stuff. I mean, there were interest over the years, and I respect it. I mean, I always feel in the end it's the filmmaker, and it's absolutely his film, and you know, I would never want it to be out there if he's not happy with it. But I just personally, I think he did a great job, and I think it's a cool movie, and I think a lot of people like it, and I think a lot of people who haven't seen it would like it. I can only sort of just nod to his feelings about it. I would love to understand it, but I've never really quite gotten it. You know, I mean, there are things in it that, of course, you know, you do, you know, you look back 20, 25 years later and you'd make some different choices or shoot something differently or whatever, but I always thought he did a great job. I mean, I think the film looks great, and I think there's a really neat tone to it, and, you know, I think it's a really cool movie.
Now, did you two meet on Home Movie?
Yeah, we met on Home Movies. He was the second AD on that. We just really, you know, took a really instant liking to each other. We both were huge Stanley Kubrick fans. It was just a lot. We just had stuff in common, but, you know, particular taste in films. And we sort of started talking about wanting to try to work together after the film was over. But we more stayed friends for a while. I mean, we didn't go right from Home Movies into thinking about Static. It was more like, gee, it'd be cool to do something together. And, you know, we'd go to films a lot and just hang out and go get Chinese food and, you know, whatever. And then he came to me with an idea. He said, you know, I've got this idea for a story, and I think you might be kind of cool for the lead character. I don't really have a worked out story, but I have this image of this guy working in a desert in a crucifix factory, and, you know, he saves the weird ones, and then this model comes into town driving this like Ferrari, and the two of them meet, and they're so different, and it leads to, you know, some kind of weird change in his life. And that was about what he had at the time that we started. And then it just evolved from there. Again, it was endless lunches over Chinese food was our big running thing. It was really funny. We would just go to, you know, several different New York Chinese restaurants and sit there. And the script probably took about almost a year to write, because we did it in bits and pieces, and I was acting in things, so my time was in and out. And we worked out the basic storyline together, and then we'd each go off and write scenes or sections and then give it to the other person, and then the other person would sort of rewrite what the first person wrote. And then it was sort of like a bill becoming a law. You know, some scenes kept changing and changing and changing and going back and forth. And, you know, there were lots of arguments, but they were always very friendly. I don't remember, you know, things ever feeling heated. It was always very, you know, fun and congenial, and you know, we just had fun with it. I mean, it was really an enjoyable process. It was really a nice collaboration. And in the end, we found a way to have a script that I, at least in my memory, we both felt good about everything that was in it. We went back and forth on a lot of things, but we always would find a way to go, okay, well, what is it that's important to you, and what is it important to me, and how do we have all that here?
How much did it change from when you finally said, okay, we're done, let's shoot this thing, because I'm sure there was a moment where you're just like champing at the bit, like, let's do this. How much did it change from that to what we actually see on screen?
It didn't change that radically. I mean, it was cut down. There were scenes that were never shot. You know, in working with the realities of a low budget, there were scenes that went by the wayside. We went, you know, that's a whole other location, and we don't really have the money for it. And the script was, we realized, a little long as we started to get towards production. There were also scenes that we shot that weren't in the final film, and, you know, and that were cut either way down or cut out. That, again, the frustrating thing about making any movie, and it's always this way, is that you kind of, you know, sometimes you have to kill your babies. I mean, it's like you may have a scene that you just love, but if it's not somehow feeding the story, then you end up taking it out. So there were some wonderful scenes that either didn't. There was a whole great scene with Amanda and her family having a Christmas meal that I remember everybody being great in, and particularly her, but it just, it didn't move the story along. There were just things like that, and then chunks of scenes would go away. But that's just the process of making a film. I've never made a film where that didn't happen. You know, Static had some of that too, but that's always par for the course. But it didn't change radically beyond that, because we were truly independently financed. I mean, this guy, Julio Caro, you know, brought in some money, and he was a close friend of Mark, and Mark's family and friends, you know, it was a lot of, you know, Mark's family had connections to other people with money, and so the financing wasn't a lot of, like, movie-type people. It was a coalition of friends of friends and connections of Julio's and all that, so there wasn't really anybody standing over our shoulder in terms of, you know, put in more of this, or, oh, God, there was one guy, you know, because we looked for financing, you know, for a while. I mean, it's always a chore with independent movies, and I remember talking to one guy from Texas, and you know, he wanted to finance the movie, but he wanted us to actually, at the end of the film, have a scene in heaven, and in heaven all the women were naked, because, well, why wouldn't they be? Because women are so beautiful naked, so we have the scene with Ernie walking around with all these naked women, and...
How can I make you happy?
I want the movie to end with a big explosion. Sky full of smoke.
It was sort of like just one of those where you just sat there with your mouth hanging open, and you just went, oh, how do I get out of here? And, you know, in terms of the actual making of the movie, it wasn't like that at all. We really were kind of on our own, so we didn't change much of our vision of things. Again, things always adapt. I mean, actors, things would happen in rehearsal, or, you know, Amanda would come up with great new dialogue, or an improvisation would happen, or, you know, so there's plenty of stuff in the movie that was adapting to what was happening, or a location would be different than we imagined, so we'd shoot it differently. But really, it's pretty close to the script.
The scenes with you and Bob Gunton are just amazing. He is so good.
He's a great guy. I mean, I had the luck to then get to, I directed him in Wild Palms, which was really fun. And, you know, he's an incredibly inventive, wonderful actor. And he was somebody that we knew we wanted. He'd been doing a play in New York called How I Got That Story, where he played essentially the Vietnam War. It was a two-character play. I believe it was him and Daniel Stern, if I remember correctly. And Daniel Stern played like a young reporter. It was his experiences going all over Vietnam during the war, interviewing different people. And Bob Gunton played everybody else. He played geisha girls, and he played tough-ass black American soldiers and everything in between. And there were, like, no props. It was one of those things where he did it all with minimal costume stuff and minimal and all voice and body language, and Mark and I were just blown away by his performance. And he was, you know, the very first person that we went to with that role, because we just thought he was, like, amazing. And, you know, we just were really happy that he wanted to do it. And again, it was that nice thing where, because the financing wasn't based on casting, it wasn't like, you know, go get somebody famous. It was just, we could cast whoever we thought was the best actor for a part.
Yeah, it must have been so much fun writing for Frank.
It was tricky. You know, Frank probably got rewritten more than any other character, because you wanted to walk that line of him being a real character and yet being really funny. And it was really a trick for both of us. And we both that was one of the characters we really kind of sweated over, because we'd write stuff and we'd go, okay, is this too silly? Is it not funny enough? Is it getting too serious? We wanted you to take him seriously. I mean, we didn't want him to just be a... I mean, he's a joke of a human being, and that he's so screwed up, but we didn't want it to be in a different movie. I mean, we had a movie where basically you actually cared about the people, even if they're oddball and eccentric. And we didn't want him to be a joke as opposed to everybody else just being odd. That was a character we actually spent a lot of time rewriting the dialogue and making it funnier and then making it less funny and going, oh, this is a great line, but is it too much of a joke? And it was a real interesting fine line to walk. You know, and then Bob did a great job as an actor selling both sides of it, because there are real moments with him where he's kind of sad and or when suddenly he is lucid. It was a tricky writing, as I remember, at least. That was some of the trickiest writing, was getting his stuff just right.
And I think the way that the town treats him is really what helps out as well.
Yeah, and again, we got very lucky. I mean, Martin Heyman, who played the sheriff, was great. He brought a lot of great attitude to it. I mean, that was the thing. It was really a piece where the actors added a lot. Not so much in like rewriting whole characters, but colorations and lines and they'd improvise just little bits and pieces, and so it just brought stuff to life, which was really exciting. And Mark was a really good director in that. You know, I mean, that's especially for a first-time director, I think that's a hard thing to do, to let people change your script and add words or change lines, or, you know, there's, I think, a lot of first-time directors, and I know I teach at Sundance, a lot of them around, a lot of young directors, and there's a tendency to be very precious. It's understandable and human, you know, and it's your baby, and, you know, you saw it just this exact way. And Mark, always from very early on, was really open to an actor doing something very different than he thought, whether it was literally changing the words or just approaching something with a different energy or a different feel than he had thought of at first. And he was always really open to going, huh, that wasn't what I imagined, but that works really good. I think that was really, you know, he showed a lot of maturity on his side, because a lot of directors take a couple of films to realize that, you know, the actor is your friend. I've been around a lot of directors, especially if they don't come out of an acting background but come out of a more technical background, that really see actors as these people who come in and mess up their stuff instead of come in and make it better. And Mark never had that. Mark really appreciated actors and what they brought.
So this was still a few years before you did The Chocolate War, and you had mentioned before that you had kind of soaked up from De Palma a lot of directing stuff. Did you learn a lot from Mark as he was going through this process? Were you kind of standing over his shoulder? And
oh, absolutely. No, one of the things that was most exciting about doing this for me was, you know, knowing that I ultimately wanted to direct and thinking, you know, that Mark really had, among other things, an amazing visual sense, and knew a lot of things about cameras that, I mean, I had done a lot of still photography, and I had made like really bad Super 8 movies and things like that. But Mark, you know, Mark's student films were beautiful. I mean, I think his student film was nominated. One of them was nominated for a Student Academy Award, and they were just technically just gorgeous. So he knew much more than I did about the technical side of things. And so watching what he did, asking him questions, all that stuff was incredibly valuable, and I felt like I learned a lot by being able just to be around, but also to just be able to sort of look through the camera and go, okay, why are you using this lens, and why, you know, and he's incredibly articulate about that stuff. So it was a kind of wonderful way to be able to work and to learn and have an apprenticeship. Although I was, you know, lucky enough that all of my films I did, I sort of saw as apprenticeships, annoyed them and.
Yeah, you really kind of had a master class looking at some of the directors that you've worked with.
Well, and I was lucky enough that it was like a master class where they were nice people who were willing to put up with me and my questions and my wanting to know things. And I mean, I could have worked with a lot of incredibly accomplished, great directors who basically were unwilling or unexcited about talking to some kid about why they did what they did. And what was fabulous was, I mean, obviously with Mark, it was really working with a peer, but it was no less true of people like De Palma and John Carpenter, that they were very indulgent of me and of my wanting to learn from them. I really hit the jackpot because I work with good directors, but I also work with good directors who were very open-hearted about my curiosity. And I feel really grateful for that. But with Mark, it was all the more so because we really were peers. And so, you know, and he would talk to me about acting. I mean, I had a lot more experience with actors and acting, and he would talk to me about how I worked as an actor and how actors work. So I like to think or hope that I was able to be useful to him as well. It really opened up a lot of stuff to me. I mean, a lot of what I learned going into making Chocolate War, I learned being around Mark, watching Mark, talking to Mark on Static.
How far along in the process did you go? Did you go from, obviously you were there at the beginning, but did you go all the way through the end and witness the editing and the soundtrack and all that?
I was around a lot during the editing. In fact, looking back, I wish I'd given Mark more time alone. You know, my one regret about the movie, and it was part of my age, was there were times that Mark would sort of say, I feel like I just need some time alone with the editor. And I felt like I would sort of not bully my way in, but I felt like I didn't give him as much space. If I produce somebody's movie now, I think I'd know a lot more about when to shut up and back away and leave them alone. Because we were friends, it was like always okay, but I feel like I was probably editing him more than I should have been. Of course, I had opinions and all that, and Mark didn't get as much time as I think he should have to have a one-on-one relationship with the editor. And I have some regrets about that, that there were times that I didn't go, okay, yes, I want to know everything and I want to be involved, but I also should, like, get out of here a little bit. I wasn't involved in the sound mix as much, and the music was really Mark. I mean, Mark had this great ear for music. I mean, he'd play me what he wanted to use, but they were his choices, and they were great choices. That was a place where I had very little in the way of collaboration other than to say, well, that's cool. But he's always had an amazing ear for music. I mean, he turns a lot of the music that still I love today, I mean, from Brian Eno to whoever, were people that Mark was the first person who kind of turned me on to their work. In terms of, you know, just the production sound, the music was great, but also we had a great sound mixer. I think his name was David, I want to say David Brownlow, but that's the film archive, so I have to look it back up again. But, you know, for a low-budget film, he recorded sound really, really well, and there were really good soundtracks to work with, which was unusual, because it was challenging situations. I mean, we were on buses, and we were in places that sound people don't like to be, because they're noisy and difficult, and he really did a great job without much time and not a lot of money for fancy equipment. But I think he, in the end, created really good dialogue tracks and stuff that didn't sound cheap, which you often, when you have a low budget, often you get the sound that's just not all that exciting. The nice thing about that film is it was before the independent movement had really gotten to be a big deal. So you had this nice, unusual situation where people were excited about working on this weird little movie, and yeah, they weren't making a lot of money, but there was a lot of artistic freedom, and it was very kind of egalitarian, and everybody, you know, everybody's input was wanted, and, you know, now there's a billion independent films, and, you know, but at that point, it wasn't anywhere near as common. So I think people working on it, there was nobody working on the film that I can remember, at least, you know, and maybe, you know, there's that rosy cloud of memory, but I don't remember anybody being jaded. You know, everybody felt like it was mostly a fairly young crew. Everybody seemed excited to be there, excited to be a part of it. Everybody seemed to have ideas about everything, about, oh, here's a cool way to do this, and here's a cool way to do that. And that's a really the nicest movie experience is when it feels like the cast and the crew are really part of the team with you as a director or a writer or whatever. You know, you're all kind of in it together. And that movie definitely had that sense.
What happened when this thing was finally done?
We finished the film and, you know, we showed it to a few studios, which I always thought was like kind of a fool's errand. And I don't think most of them lasted past the credits. I mean, because nobody was putting out a film. I mean, certainly Universal wasn't going to be putting out a film like this, you know. I mean, it just wasn't what was happening. There was a company called Cinecom, which had been doing the early John Sayles films. I mean, there were independent films. It wasn't like we were the first ones. It wasn't as big as it is now with so many of them getting made. But Cinecom was sort of like what Miramax was when the Weinsteins were running it. It was kind of the biggest of the we put out little movies companies. And they had been interested, and it was very frustrating because it was all, you know, I wasn't involved with the deal making, but there was never, a deal was just never struck with them. And I always thought that was kind of a mistake because they were so good at what they did, and they were kind of, I mean, not a monopoly, but there was really nobody else around that was doing well with independent films. I mean, I think they had put out Brother from Another Planet. They were the only ones that were putting out independent movies and actually like making some money and making some noise with them. And so when, you know, the financier types couldn't come to terms with them, and we were like, well, we'll get somebody else, you know, I think that was, I looking back, think that was a mistake. I think we missed a chance to have the film get a much wider audience. So then we started playing in some film festivals, and it was funny, like we played in the U.S. Film Festival, which is now Sundance, but it wasn't called Sundance at that point. And it wasn't a big deal festival at all. It was funny. It was like the theaters would be like one-third full, and most of the people there were like the filmmakers and, you know, local people who were interested in going to see movies. You didn't have a lot of press, or it was such a different vibe than just a few years later. I think it was I guess it was 2 years later or 3 years later that Sex, Lies, and Videotape went there and got bought for a lot of money, took off, made a ton of money, and suddenly everybody looked at Sundance and went, whoa, there's serious cash to be made here, and the whole feeling of the festival changed into a major event. But we were there with this film, you know, back when it was some like little tiny festival that nobody really cared about. And we played in a number of festivals. We played the Chicago Festival. We played, you know, we did well. We got nice reviews. But nobody jumped on distributing the film because that was a time where, again, there really weren't many companies doing odd little movies. Finally, it ended up with the company that made Chocolate War also owned a distribution company. So they bought it for both theatrical and video, although basically they were pretty honest that they were going to focus on a video release because they didn't think there was a big theatrical audience for that kind of movie. So they didn't put a lot of, you know, opened in New York and L.A. for a couple of weeks, but it never really had a much of a theatrical life. And I would say that was too bad because I think it could have. Where it did do very well was in Europe, particularly in England. It had a really, it was sort of the flip side of the coin in England. It played for months in theaters in England and did very well. And I think to this day continues to get screened on Channel 4 and all that. I mean, you know, Mark has never wanted the film out on video, but I believe that they still own the rights to screen it on TV there, and I think it still does screen there. And we got most amazing set of reviews in England. I mean, it was just sort of, you know, the whole English experience of this film was sort of about as good as it could possibly be in terms of reception, but also just success. I mean, it just, I think, performed much better than even people thought it was going to. So that kind of balanced out the fact that in America we never really got a chance. We got some very good reviews, but we never really got a chance to find much of an audience.
You know, it's showing up on Amazon as being on DVD, but it looks like a total bootleg.
Yeah, I think it is a bootleg. I've seen it because people have mentioned it to me, and I mean, I don't think it's a bootleg. I know it's a bootleg because it's not. You know, but to be honest, and I'm going to say something probably that's wildly politically incorrect, I don't have a big problem with that. I think pirating is like really a big problem, but I think if there's no other way that somebody can see a film, you know, my film Midnight Clear has been out of print, and like if I heard somebody like pirated it and looked at it, I certainly wouldn't be calling the cops because it's like, you know, when you create something, you want people to see it. And so I feel very differently about films that are available and somebody's pirating it to undercut the sales of a film or, you know, putting it on for up for download when the company is trying to actively make their money back with it. And I think that's really hurt films, especially independent films, because video world was a lot of what allowed people to take risks on independent films because they feel like they'd get their money back there. And as pirating gets cut further and further into that, it's really hurt getting these films made. But to me, if there's a film that like no one's putting out and it's just sitting on a shelf and it's a film that people have an artistic interest in, I can't blame someone if they, you know, I first saw Fear and Desire, the Kubrick film, on a pirated version. You know, I mean, I just think that's a different thing to me. I mean, just morally, you know, and probably, you know, there'll be a lot of people who will want to kill me for saying that because the party line is you're supposed to say any sort of bootleg is just always wrong. But to me, there's a gray area of films that are unseeable otherwise. And I'm certainly not going to blame anybody for, you know, so I saw that it was up on Amazon, but I wasn't going to call Amazon and go, hey, you know, that's not authorized because I feel like, you know, if somebody wants to see the film badly enough that they can see it. And if I don't get my whatever 50 cents a copy residuals, I'll live without it. But again, that's me, and probably a lot of people would disagree with me.
From what I hear, it's not a very good copy, but apparently it's showing on Impact on the on-demand channel too, which is kind of is strange to me because it's more of an action channel.
Very strange on a lot of levels. Yeah, I didn't know that. And I can't imagine that they would be able to do that without Mark's blessing, but I know Mark has been, you know, turned down much more logical offers from, you know, bigger cable channels and from video places. So maybe they have some strange old, you know, who knows what their history as a company is, but maybe they have some weird, you know, right thing that goes back to years when they were some other company or something, because that is surprising to me. But, you know, I think it's great. I mean, I think if it's out there to be seen, then wonderful. I think there should be a beautiful, you know, Blu-ray version of it out there for people who want it. But, again, I had that conversation with Mark. He wasn't interested, and past a certain point, it's really good. It's got to be his call.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so blue just thinking about you. Decorations of red on a green.
street won't be the same, dear, if you're not here with me. And when
welcome back to the Projection Booth. I'll tell you, it is always a pleasure to talk to Keith Gordon. I spoke to him, gosh, like over a decade ago, where I talked to him quite a bit about his films Mother Night and A Midnight Clear, as well as his acting gigs, some of them such as Christine, Back to School, Jaws 2. If folks are interested, they can read that interview in Impossibly Funky, a Cashier's Du Cinemart collection. And hey, they can also read an article by my co-host this week, Chris Cummins, all about the unfilmed version of Gremlins.
Yay!
Yay! Chris, we've talked a lot about Mark Romanek, but let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Keith Gordon and what he brought to Static.
Yeah, Keith Gordon is a tremendous actor, and I keep using the word tremendous, but it's very, very appropriate here. He gives a really quiet, an understated and sad performance in this movie. For those who haven't seen it, he is a brilliant, you know, aspiring inventor who, before the events of the film, his parents die in a car accident. And that off-screen event really influences his actions and his performance. So he's a guy who's in this in the film, he's in a very kind of subtle, weird love triangle between two women. One is Amanda Plummer's character, and another is a waitress in the diner he frequents. And so along with, you know, this weird tension he has between the two of them, he's also dealing with the grief of his parents, his death, and that grief directly leads him to create this invention that he creates in the film. And what I found most interesting is he plays it, you know, he kind of walks a tightrope in the movie where he's got a kind of mischief going on at times, but other times he just seems really sad, and especially in the second half of the film, he definitely plays it completely different, at least I feel, than he plays Ernie in the first half. I don't know, you know, what your feelings are on that, Mike.
Well, yeah, he's very, very sincere. He's definitely the audience's foil in this one. You know, it's like, I think that his interactions with his cousin Frank really tell us a lot about the character of Ernie, because he likes Frank a lot, even though Frank is kind of a nut, and he's very patient with him, really handles him the right way, handles Frank's family the right way.
Frank is this fascinating character who is obsessed that America is going to go to war with Russia at any minute. He's got this whole angle, this whole pseudo-religious angle that he's going as a preacher to try to reel people in. He's an interesting guy. When he first meets Amanda Plummer, he thinks she's working for the CIA, and he gets one of the film's best lines when he asks Keith Gordon, you know this whore of Moscow? Which is a very, very strange and hilarious line. And he's married to this woman who is somewhat obsessed with the drink Tang, which they drink in amazingly large pitchers. He's got two twin boys who he named North and South, and these are all some of the quirky elements of the film. But so he's not a very likable character, but the thing is, he genuinely loves Ernie, and Ernie genuinely loves him. And their performances, their interactions together are extremely human and extremely real. And given the exaggerated and almost, for lack of a better word, surreal happenings that surround those two characters in the film, it's one of the most real relations. In fact, I'm just going to say it is the most real relationship in the film, and that's largely thanks to Keith Gordon's performance.
Even though I know that this was a scripted film, it feels like they were very open to interpretation of these characters, and especially with an actor of Bob Gunton's stature, they probably just said, do what you want, come on in, let's see what, and if it works, it works. And Gordon, by this point, has really, he's been to enough rodeos that he knows what works, what doesn't. And I think a lot of the film's strength is that he's right there at the center of all this insanity, basically, and really is our guide through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I talked to Keith Gordon years and years ago, I was kind of riding his case a little bit, because I was like, hey, you know, what's going on with the Christmas theme in your films, man? You know, you've got a lot of Christmas in your movies, you know, like in the beginning of Mother Night, they're playing an old Bing Crosby Christmas song. And in Midnight Clear, a lot of it takes place at Christmas and stuff. And then I'm watching Static and I'm like,
Oh, yeah, I forgot that this took place at Christmas.
Actually, I'm about to start reading. There's a book by Alonzo Duralde called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, and I'm about to dive into that. And I'm kind of hoping Static is in there because it's very much an off-kilter Christmas movie in a way, and that's something that it's been 11 years since I've seen it. You know, I mean, I watched it yesterday, obviously, but before that it was 11 years, and I forgot about the Christmas theme, and the Christmas theme does very nicely play into the kind of religious undertones of the film, and it is a nicely, spoiler alert, downbeat Christmas movie, ultimately.
It's not a Charlie Brown Christmas by any means, though you could kind of see Charlie Brown and Ernie Glick hanging out together at some point.
I think that Frank could be what Linus turns into when he grows up, because Linus seems a little misguided about a few things, and I think Frank is as well, so, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of give up the security blanket for the Fallout suit or something. So, Chris, tell me, what are your thoughts about the end of the film? I mean, obviously, we've given away a few spoilers on this episode, but I don't care, because this film is so interesting. I think it needs to be dissected a little bit more than just talked about what happens point A to B to C. So what are your thoughts as far as the end of the film?
For those who haven't seen it, Keith Gordon invents this this device that allows people to see a live image of heaven. The problem is he's the only one who can see it. He can't understand why this is so. So he decides that he's going to hijack a bus to get media attention. On the bus are a bunch of really friendly elderly people who are just enchanted with the idea that heaven exists because, you know, it kind of makes their lives easier as they're getting closer to the end of it to know that there's something more than just this earthly existence. Things go wrong really quick. The bus explodes, and Ernie and everyone aboard dies. The final shot of the film is Amanda Plummer goes to his house, and, you know, she kind of looks in the machine. There's a very effective shot of her fingers in front of the screen, which is just showing static. And then the very final shot of the film is her driving away in the car, much like she did the beginning of the film, just her in her car. But she has a very, like, wry smile on her face. And to me, the way I interpreted that movie is people who are in intense stages of grief, Ernie's device works for. It gives them that hope. So it could be a placebo effect. It could be purely psychological. But in a way, Ernie's device does work. And his life was, you know, it did have meaning because it brought her the clarity that she was seeking in the beginning when she was driving to him. And at the end, she has what she was looking for, and ultimately his invention was successful. At least that's the way I interpret the film.
She is in such a crisis at the beginning. I mean, we don't necessarily see why she has her meltdown, but she does. And this movie is really kind of Amanda Plummer's movie when you look at the way it's structured, seeing her at the beginning, seeing her at the end and all that. And yeah, I definitely see that, you know, and I'm so glad that they didn't do something cheesy with the end of this where it was like, you know, little Ernie on the TV screen waving or something, you know.
Yeah,
I think they leave it ambiguous enough. And you're right, that smile just kind of, you know, playing around the edges of her mouth there really tells you everything that you need to know when it comes to how this is. Or you can interpret it a completely different way and just be like, okay, Ernie tried to do his best and she's moving on to some other town or something. But I would rather think of it the way that you interpreted it.
Romanek, it's to his credit that a lot of, and not just the ending in the film, he never has to spell anything out. I mean, this is a movie that is pretty much completely exposition free, and I like that, you know, he's just kind of throwing you into this world and you're on your own in it. You're either going to sink or swim. And for me, the experience of the movie is so great because I really feel like he's allowing you to come up with your own interpretation and to totally project your own experiences into the film, into Ernie's character, whether you can relate to him or not, and then take away what you will from the film. And that's ultimately what I think its biggest legacy is. It's just this very smart and, like you said, quirky film that it does lead you to think.
Being done in 1985, I mean, this wasn't really like this Hallmark period of independent films like this. I mean, now you go to a film festival or you go to your local art house or whatever, you're going to see there aren't films that are exactly like Static, but they're going to have that kind of offbeat character, you know, and it's very, I mean, God, they're almost like clones of one another when you see some of these. It's just like, oh, look at this kid has a problem, and we know that it'll be resolved by the third act, and his parents are divorced, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, for God's sake, Sundance filmmakers, can you please come up with a new story? This was definitely a different story, and it really, to me, I mean, I know it's cliche to say this, it was a little bit of ahead of its time. You know, I wish that this had the same kind of distribution channels that some of these films that were coming out 90, 91, 92, some of those had, didn't have those opportunities. I mean, there was an indie film market back then, but it was nowhere near, you know, these kind of like, you know, Anders and Rockwell and Tarantino Rodriguez, like that kind of batch of filmmakers. So I think this really kind of set a bar that a lot of people really haven't reached yet with their independent films.
I kind of equate this movie with Miracle Mile, which not just because they were both shown on Prism at the same time, but because they're both very interesting, downbeat, but thoughtful films of the 80s, and they're very much of their time. And I feel that they're films that, if they were released a few years later, they would have caught on much, much more.
We're going to take another break, and we'll play a clip from next week's show.
In 1994, the world is controlled by one power.
Hey, hey,
hey, it's on the way. Hey, 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 it's on the way. Hey, 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 it's on the way. The apple is success. Brings you everything.
What about happiness?
Child of love, show me, tell me.
I wanted to release Bibi from a contract.
Cheers.
Where is she?
Apple is the temptation. The apple is the experience.
Take the apple! Whoa! Where's the apple?
And we're back. That was a preview for next week's show, all about The Apple, a 1980 disco musical set in the distant future of 1994.
All right.
So before I go, I want to thank this week's co-host, Chris Cummins, for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, Mike. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, sir. You know, Chris and I finally, I mean, we've been talking via email for God knows how long, and Chris was one of my longtime contributors for Cashiers to Cinemart, and we finally met. God, that was like just about a year ago, I think.
Last November, yeah, at the Philly reading.
Great to meet you finally, and then I know you do a lot of freelance stuff, so where can folks go to read some of your fine prose these days?
Right now, the main places are Topless Robot, toplessrobot.com, and geekadelphia.com. They're seem to be the two primary places. You can follow me on the Twitter. My Twitter handle is Bionic Bigfoot. And also, I have an article about the fantastic film Breaking Glass and the brand new issue of Cashiers du Cinemart, which is a fantastic publication. So everybody should check that out as well.
All right, so thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to check back for more episodes of The Projection Booth over at iTunes via Stitcher or on Jackalope Radio. And you can always get the lowdown from the website projection-booth.com.